From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationship with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Thanks for tuning in. And joining us on the phone is Professor Michael Mann. He's the Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State University, among other things, author of many books, including a new one, just released, I believe it's just released today. It's called The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Professor Mann, thank you so much for joining us, Nell and myself, on This Green Earth this morning.
It's great to be with you both.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us and talk about your new book, which I believe is today the date of release?
It absolutely is, yep.
Well, we're extra privileged to be able to chat with you about this book, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Before we do get into the book, we kind of mentioned in our introduction the fact that 2020 has been determined by at least one meteorological agency, I believe it's the European Meteorological Agency or so, that 2020 tied 2016 as the warmest on record. Your thoughts on that? Yeah. Does that surprise you at all?
Unfortunately, it doesn't. In fact, it's a bit like Groundhog Day, the film Groundhog Day. Every year now, just about, we get word of yet a new record. And that's what we expect as the planet continues to warm up. The surface of the planet is warming up. The oceans are warming up. And in fact, we'll have something to say about that a few days from now with some of the science that we've done looking at ocean heating. So yes, climate change proceeds headlong. We head down this path and the planet will continue to warm up until we get our carbon emissions under control.
And you know back in 2000, 2002, 2004, we were having conversations about this is what's going to happen, this is what our models show, by 2020 we'll be at such and such a warming. Do you think that warming is unfolding in the way that those models back in the late 90s and early 2000s suggested?
Yeah, to quote or paraphrase my good friend Sherwood Rowland, who's no longer with us, unfortunately, a great scientist who was co-awarded the Nobel Prize for his work on ozone depletion. And he said something to the effect that what good are our models and our model predictions if we're only to watch them come true? And it's a Pyrrhic victory, indeed, to watch our predictions come true, but that's what's happening. And, you know, if you don't trust the scientists, if you're a climate change contrarian, you don't believe the climate models, well, look at ExxonMobil, as I describe in The New Climate War. Back in the 1970s and early 80s, their own internal documents made a prediction of the warming of the planet that we would expect and the impacts that we would expect if we continued to burn fossil fuels. They even characterized the potential implications as catastrophic. That's to use ExxonMobil's own words. And of course their actions help ensure that we did not act to avert the climate crisis, and that's where we are now. Of course, the good news is that there is still time to prevent the worst impacts of climate change, but we're much farther down this road than we ever should have allowed ourselves to be, and that is in large part because of the disinformation campaign by fossil fuel interests like ExxonMobil and those doing their bidding.
Well, as we've said, you know, the book is called The New Climate War. What is, you know, what's the new climate war versus the old climate war?
Yeah, thanks. So, you know, the old climate war is really the disinformation campaign over the past several decades by the fossil fuel industry and those promoting their interests to discredit the science of climate change, to discredit the scientists. And I came face to face with that campaign when my colleagues and I published the so-called hockey stick curve, a now iconic sort of graph in the climate change debate. When we published that two decades ago, I found myself at the center of those attacks. Well, here's the thing. We've arrived now at the point where the impacts of climate change, because of that inaction because we haven't acted, the impacts are no longer subtle. We're seeing them play out in real time in the form of extreme weather disasters, heat waves, wildfires, floods, superstorms, droughts like we've never seen before. So it's very difficult for the forces of inaction, the inactivists, as I call them, to argue that it isn't happening, or even that it isn't our, you know, due to our activities. Instead, they've now engaged in a new array of tactics to thwart efforts to act on climate. And that consists of efforts to divide the community, to deflect attention away from the needed policy solutions towards individual behavior, as if it's just a matter of individuals taking actions themselves. Without, you know, incentives and government policy, promoting doom and despair. They don't care about the path that we take to inaction. They just care about the destination. So they're more than happy to convince some, you know, environmentally aware people that, in fact, it's too late. Things are so bad that there's nothing we can do. The science doesn't support that. But too many people now have been sort of caught up in this sort of doom mongering, and then finally false solutions like geoengineering. Let's just tamper with our planet in some other way to try to offset the warming rather than solving the problem at its source, which is carbon pollution. These are all tactics now that are being deployed by, you know, the inactivists in their ongoing war on climate action, and that's the new climate war.
So basically, like you say, a delay or defer rather than deny, kind of slow walk the process, if there's any walking of the process at all on their end.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Have you seen any voices, either individual voices or organizations who back in the late 90s and 2000s, maybe, you know, 2010 or so, who once denied climate change, at least has come around to even suggest that maybe they were wrong in some of these, or kind of quieted their voice, their denial voices?
There are, particularly, I mean, many of the climate change deniers in the past were on one side of our political spectrum, typically Republicans in the Republican Party. Has been closely tied to the fossil fuel industry, so that's no coincidence. And their operatives and the fossil fuel industry has worked hard to make climate change denial part of the tribal identity today of being a Republican. They've been very effective at sort of promoting that ideology within the Republican Party. But here's the thing, again, the impacts are impossible to deny at this point. And a lot of people have come along, especially younger conservatives, young Republicans, overwhelmingly favor action on climate. And even some of the principal players who did play a role in the past. I mean, the Rockefeller Foundation Fund. Well, Rockefeller fortune was made in substantial part from fossil fuels a century ago. But now the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, which is sort of the legacy of the Rockefeller estate, has actually taken a very firm stance in acting on climate. They've divested of fossil fuel holdings, encouraged others to do so. And Frank Luntz, who was a Republican pollster, who a couple decades ago helped the Republican Party with their messaging aimed at discrediting the science, Frank Luntz has flipped. He's apologized for having done that. He said, you know, climate change, it's clear, it's real, it's a problem. And he is now actually helping climate advocates with their messaging, helping them be more effective. And so we have seen sort of this turn in the tide, and I think we're at this critical juncture now where we're ready for a tipping point, not the dangerous tipping points, climate tipping points that we fear, like the catastrophic melting of the ice sheets, and that's something that will, you know, undoubtedly happen if we continue down this road, but instead a tipping point in the public consciousness where we do now finally what's necessary to avert catastrophe while there's still time.
Right. I'm glad you mentioned Frank Luntz, because that's the name, when I came across that in the book, that surprised me. when you mention him as flipping,
yeah.
because he was a central messenger or central, he played a central role in kind of configuring the Republican conservative yeah. message about climate change back in the late 90s and early 2000s with a lot of his surveys and market research, et cetera. So there are folks around there who have gone as far as to say, hey, you know what? I was wrong. And I'm actually here to help the other side. So that is encouraging, which lends itself to kind of your yeah. overall optimistic point of view within the book.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I'm not a Pollyanna.
Right.
I mean, it's we're not going to avoid dangerous climate change. It's already upon us. We're already dealing with a devastating impact. So we're too far down this road already. That's the bad news. And yes, there is great urgency in acting immediately. If we are to avert warming the planet by more than a degree and a half Celsius, about 3 degrees Fahrenheit, which is where we'll start to see the worst impacts of climate change, we need to bring our carbon emissions down by a factor of 2 within the next decade. So it's a monumental task. There's great urgency, but there is agency as well. Once we stop burning carbon and putting carbon pollution into the atmosphere, the best available science tells us that the surface of the planet will actually stop warming up pretty quickly within a few years. So our impacts now have a direct and immediate impact on this problem.
So in the recent months, obviously the Biden campaign talked a lot about climate change and action to prevent climate change, and won with that as part of their platform. How do you think that'll impact kind of the next steps we take and maybe the general public opinion surrounding climate and climate action?
Yeah, thanks for that comment. I think it's really important that Joe Biden was really the first president not just to advocate climate policies, but literally to campaign on them. It was an important part of his campaign, and that means he has a mandate to lead on the climate issue. And we've already seen that in the sort of formative days of the administration, the appointments that he's made, key cabinet positions and appointments to run the various agencies, that he's committed to an all-agency approach, literally using every agency of the government to act on this problem. And that is very encouraging. What's also encouraging is there now seems to be some support within at least some enclaves of the Republican Party for some sort of action. Republicans now are coming to the table and negotiating, in part out of their fear that they might get a solution that they don't like, something very expansive like the Green New Deal, very wide-ranging and expansive government approach. And so that sort of brought them to the table. And I think there is the possibility, the very real possibility within the next couple of years of meaningful climate legislation being brought to the Senate floor and actually passing the Senate. And that would, of course, complement everything that the Biden administration is doing through executive action. So there's a real opportunity for us to move forward, for us to reestablish leadership globally, and for that to help bring the rest of the world community along before it's too late.
Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Michael Mann. He's a distinguished professor of atmospheric science at Penn State University, and he's here talking about his new book, just released today. It's called The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. And you mention in the book, there's kind of a four-part battle plan, as you describe it, to this. You kind of touched on some of them. First of all, disregard the doomsayers. So you talked about the doomsayers that are out there. What's the point? Or, look, I've heard some people also say, look, this is God's will. This is how it'll unfold, and God has a plan for us. So there's a religious aspect to the doomsaying aspect to this. A child shall lead the way. You kind of touched on it, I believe, that the youth play an important role. Do you want to add a little more to that?
Yeah, thanks. Absolutely. And I was delighted that Greta Thunberg, who's sort of essentially the leader of the world youth climate movement, was nice enough to write a blurb for the book. And she and her fellow youth climate leaders have really changed the entire dialogue. They've changed the conversation. They've helped recenter this issue where, you know, firmly where it belongs. It's not just a matter of science and economics and policy and politics. This is a matter of ethics, of intergenerational ethics. Our obligation not to destroy this planet for future generations. And they've helped recenter the conversation about that directive. And it's really, in my view, combined with other social movements, movements surrounding issues of climate justice and racial equality, that have helped energize the climate movement, a favorable shift in our politics and the political winds, so that we now have a president and the Congress willing to act. So a lot of things have come together, but the youth climate movement is absolutely critical in sort of shifting the entire discussion, and it's part of what gives me inspiration. It serves as an inspiration for me. These kids who are devoting their lives, their youth, which they could be spending doing other things, playing and having a good time, but so many have devoted their youth to trying to ensure that we act on this problem before it's too late, because that is really what it's about. I have a 15-year-old daughter. I don't want our generation to be the generation that destroyed the planet for future generations. And there is still time to make sure that that isn't our legacy. And so that's what it's about.
Well, then the segue, another part of your battle plan, you suggest, is simply educate, educate, educate. And the youth are playing, doing their best to play a role, but they're learning a lot, and they're educating us at times.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And in fact, one of the more remarkable things that I note in the book is that OPEC, this international consortium of major oil producers, Middle Eastern countries, and South American countries, OPEC, which sort of represents the world's fossil fuel industry's interests, has declared Greta Thunberg and her fellow youth climate protesters as the greatest threat to them, to their industry. And that tells you that they recognize this generational shift and the power behind the youth climate movement. Here's the thing. It also means these kids have a target on their backs, and they've been attacked and vilified and intimidated, and we can't allow that to happen. They've given us sort of a foot in the door, but we now have to pry that door open. We have to make sure that their efforts haven't been in vain. And so it's up to the rest of us, to the adults in the world who are in a position to actually affect change, to affect policy, to pressure our policymakers and vote. It's up to us to do that for them.
As we look forward, what kinds of policies do you see being the most impactful and efficient, and also maybe those that have the best chance for moving forward in this, I don't know, political atmosphere? What are our best, what are our best policy options?
Yeah. So, a lot of us would like to see something very expansive like a Green New Deal. We have a whole bunch of societal problems that are interconnected, and climate is interconnected with issues of racial justice and equality and opportunity. All of these, look, we want to see progress on all of those things. But we're going to have a closely divided Congress, and that's what the book went to press in August. And so I had to sort of figure out where I thought we would be at this point. And we sort of threaded the needle pretty accurately there. We're in a position where there is a modest positive shift in the political headwinds with a president, Joe Biden, who is willing to act on climate. But we have a closely divided Congress, and that means that there will need to be some sort of compromise to get climate legislation. And I think we do need climate legislation to complement the executive actions that Joe Biden and his administration are taking. And those actions are important. International diplomacy to secure binding commitments from all the countries of the world to go beyond the Paris Agreement, because that's what we have to do at this point. We have to go beyond the current commitments under the initial Paris Agreement, and appointing people to all of the agencies to make sure we incorporate climate-friendly policies across our government. But ultimately, we need to massively shift away from our dependence on fossil fuels towards renewable energy. That means we need a market signal. We need incentives, subsidies for renewable energy. We need a price on carbon, in my view, and how we do that is subject to a worthy discussion and debate. And you know, I think that you know we will have a divided Congress that it's unlikely to see something that resembles the current sort of version of the Green New Deal proposed by Ed Markey or AOC, something like that pass Congress. There probably just is not enough political support for that. But there is, I think, a consensus for reasonable, reasonably meaningful climate legislation, which would include carbon pricing and include subsidies for renewable energy. And look, in that that stimulus bill passed overwhelmingly, Congress a couple weeks ago, contained $35 billion for renewable and clean energy, demonstrating that there is an emerging consensus to provide those sorts of incentives. So I'm, again, optimistic we can make progress. It probably, again, won't be the sort of legislation in Congress that many climate advocates would have liked to have seen, and which might have been possible if there was more of a, there had been a larger sort of blue wave in this last election, but that didn't quite materialize. And so we are going to need compromise to move ahead now to put us in a position where maybe we can even move forward with much bolder climate legislation in the future when there's an even greater mandate and a greater majority for that sort of action in Congress.
We're speaking with Michael Mann. He's the distinguished professor of atmospheric science at Penn State University. We're talking about his new book, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. I know we're at the bottom of the hour. Professor Mann, do you have a few more minutes? We're getting a few questions being texted and emailed to us.
Absolutely.
Oh,
let's do it.
All right. Perfect. Because you mentioned some market incentives. The free market can play a big role in helping to change not only their behavior but reduce carbon emissions. Are you optimistic or happy to see a lot of investment banks like Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, BlackRock, et cetera, announcing that they're not going to invest their money in fossil fuel extraction programs, et cetera?
Yeah, absolutely. The finance sector, banking industry is playing a really important role here. I spent some time down in Australia last year, and they are really taking a leadership. Their superannuation funds, super funds, because employers are required to put substantial amounts of money into these funds for their employees. And so they have some of the largest, basically mutual funds, superannuation funds, or super funds, as they call them, anywhere else in the world. And the fact that some of their large super funds are acting, you mentioned BlackRock, Bank of England has indicated that they are going to sharply decrease their funding for fossil fuel projects. That's part of the solution. I call that sort of supply side. There are things that we can do to limit the supply of fossil fuels, and not providing funding for new fossil fuel infrastructure, not providing subsidies to the fossil fuel industry, and Joe Biden has indicated a commitment to that. Not building new pipelines, new infrastructure for the fossil fuel industry. That's sort of the supply side, and we need that. But that goes hand in hand with the demand side of the problem, which is mechanisms like carbon pricing and subsidies for renewable energy that help level the playing field, decrease demand for fossil fuels in the public, and allow renewable energy to compete more fairly against fossil fuels. We're going to need an all-hands-on-deck approach to solve this problem, and we need every tool in the toolbox to do it.
Kind of shifting back to some science, a listener texts, their question is, we talk about in terms, scientists like to say, we have warming that's already baked into our cake, per se. How much more warming do you see if, you know, policies are enacted and we can begin to flatten the curve on carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere, how much warming does remain in the atmosphere?
And that's really where there's some good news in the science over the past 10 years. And I talk about this in the book. We used to think that we would be committed to additional surface warming for decades down the road, even if we stopped burning fossil fuels cold turkey. And that was because of what's known as committed warming, where just the thermal inertia of the oceans. The oceans continue to warm up in response to the greenhouse gases we put into the atmosphere. Sort of like a big ship, it's difficult to steer quickly. It has inertia. The climate system has inertia as well. Now, that sort of thinking was based on outdated experiments that we now understand to have been flawed. We used to treat carbon dioxide levels as if they were a simple knob in the model, and you turn that knob up. But that's not how it actually works. In the real world, the atmosphere is coupled to the biosphere and the oceans. And when we put carbon into the atmosphere, yes, some of it stays in the atmosphere, but the oceans and the biosphere actually suck some of that carbon out of the atmosphere. So it's a very dynamic process. And when we model that full dynamic process, what we find is that the committed warming, which would cause things to warm for decades into the future, is offset by the fact that the oceans start pulling some of that atmospheric CO2 that's in the atmosphere. They continue to pull it out of the atmosphere after we stop burning carbon. And so CO2 levels, carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere actually start dropping. And that effect, that decrease in the greenhouse effect of that CO2, offsets the committed warming. And the net result is that the warming that we get, the level that we basically end up at, is determined by the cumulative emissions up to that point in time, which is to say, if we stop burning carbon right now, the surface warming basically stops within a few years. That means there's an immediate and direct impact of our actions. Now, some of the components of the climate system, like the ice sheets, may continue to respond decades down the road. So, you know, there are still concerns that we commit to additional sea level rise and other impacts for decades into the future. But at least as far as the surface warming is concerned and the impact that's having, that stabilizes pretty quickly. And so there is urgency, but as I like to say, there is agency. There's a direct impact of our actions.
Right. So there, like I say, impacts as far as, say, physical, chemical, and biological impacts may still unfold in one form or another because, say, for example, as the oceans continue to absorb CO2, that has a tendency to lower pH, increase our carbonic acid, and then that has its knock-on effect, chemical and biological effects. So there's still impacts there. But you're saying that a reduction of carbon emissions could have a more could have a quicker slowing of warming than was first or was for a time had thought had occurred. I'm a little mumbling.
Right, and some of the and some of the impacts of that surface warming, for example, the extreme weather events that are sort of that are caused by surface warming, we believe those impacts level out pretty quickly. There are other longer legacy components of the system, as you allude to, the acidification of the ocean unfortunately proceeds. And again, that underscores the urgency. We need to bring carbon emissions down to zero as quickly as we possibly can because there's no way to avoid impacts.
Right.
But some of the worst impacts can be avoided. There is a direct impact on surface warming if we reduce carbon emissions dramatically now.
So for those of our listeners who are thinking, you know, who are feeling inspired by this, who are wanting to do something, what do you see as the most effective actions that an individual can take?
Yeah, so, you know, the most important, there's a lot of talk and that's a whole nother conversation we didn't have time to get into about individual action, personal actions. And sure, we should all do those things that we can do in our everyday lives that decrease our environmental footprint and our carbon footprint. Often they save us money, they make us healthier, they make us feel better, and they set a good example for others. So let's do those things, but let's not fall into the trap of thinking that those individual behavioral changes are somehow the solution to the problem. We need structural change. We need systematic changes. We need policies that will incentivize this dramatic shift away from fossil fuels to renewable energy. And we need politicians who will support those policies. And that means we have to use every tool at our disposal as citizens to hold our policymakers accountable. Voting is part of it. And we saw that voting really does make a difference, and that we now have a government in the United States is willing to act on climate. But we have to continue to hold those policymakers accountable. We have to speak out. We have to make sure climate change is part of our daily conversation with other people, that there's a level of awareness and demand that our politicians can't ignore, and that our civil institutions, our companies and corporations, again, it's an all-hands-on-deck problem. We need action in all quarters of society, and that means doing everything we can in our everyday lives to make sure that we get those systemic changes. Well, yeah, doing what you can to decrease your own carbon footprint at the same time. It's a win-win situation.
Well, if voting doesn't matter, it's a perfect example of how it does matter, because in 4 years, we flipped the House, we flipped the Senate, and we flipped the White House. So if you don't think voting matters, you're not paying attention. And now hopefully we'll flip policy too. Although I do have to say, Professor Mann, and you kind of touch on this, some parallels between the coronavirus pandemic and how we've been responding to it, and how we've been trying to respond to climate change. I like to think that nature kind of unleashed this virus as its own way, as its own carbon reduction program. Nature playing a role herself in this. But that's go ahead.
There are a lot of lessons that we can take away from the pandemic. And some of the lessons are difficult ones. The dangers and the deadliness of science denial. We've seen it play out, the denial of the needed social distancing, mask wearing policies by, the outgoing president and those promoting his agenda. We can measure the toll of that science denialism in hundreds of thousands of lost human lives. Climate change denial will lead to even more lost lives. If we don't act on the climate crisis, well, that's an even greater crisis that won't go away. A year from now, the COVID-19 crisis will largely, not entirely, but largely be in our rear view mirror, but the climate crisis will still loom there. Now, the actions that we took, the social distancing, decreased transportation, it did lower global carbon emissions. It looks like it'll be a roughly 7% reduction in carbon emissions for 2020. That's the good news. The bad news is that we need to do that much every year for the next 10 years. That means 7% more this year and 7% beyond that the following year. And so individual actions, behavioral changes alone aren't going to get us that. We need fundamental structural change. And so while it does show that there's agency, that we can do something to reduce our carbon emissions, there is no replacement for the needed systemic changes, and we have to focus on that as well. Finally, I think there's a message from coronavirus about our fragility. Look how fragilely dependent we are. The planet of nearly 8 billion people that has finite food and water and space, and a tiny microscopic organism can turn that world upside down and bring us to our knees. That really speaks to some larger questions we have to ask about how we can continue to live sustainably on a finite planet.
The name of the book is The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. The author is Michael Mann. He's the Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State University. Professor Mann, do you have a website or so that people can read more about your work and efforts?
Absolutely. Folks can go to www.michaelmann.net. And I'm also on Twitter, Michael E. Mann at Twitter, Michael Mann Scientist on Facebook and Instagram. And so I always look forward to engaging with folks offline in those venues as well.
Well, good for you. I'm sure those are fascinating
conversations.
Yeah, I'm sure those are fascinating conversations at times. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us this morning. And I think we'll stay in touch as the new administration rolls out its policies and procedures and programs, and get your thoughts on those things.
Yeah, thanks so much. I really enjoyed talking with both of you, and I look forward to staying in touch in the future.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of This Green Earth.
And if you did, we hope you'll take a minute to rate us, share us, and leave a comment.
You can email us your thoughts and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Join us next week on This Green Earth.